You are called, I just rehearsed it, Mar Wolfgang Mixer, and you're from Iceland.
Correct.
Happy to have you in our studio.
Thank you.
So, you're from Iceland and you are doing some work on the economics of Iceland, but what exactly are you doing? What's your function or your profession?
My background is in finance. I began working in finance in America, United States, at Thien Witter. That's a brokerage company that became part of Morgan Stanley today. I worked there for 1 year. At that point in time, 1997, the Icelandic banking system was changing. It was evolving very rapidly.
In what way?
For the longest time, banking had been very domesticated and very rigid, controlled by politics mainly. The three main banks were called Landsbanki Íslands, which was basically the bank that was controlled very much by general politicians. We had the agricultural bank, and like the name suggests, it was, had been for the longest time servicing agricultural business. And then we had what was called Íslandsbanki, which was basically a bank that in 1990 had been combined from a few smaller banks. Those banks had one thing in common: they were servicing certain groups, certain pressure groups, or, for example, worker union banks, like the Commerce Bank of Iceland. So we had these three banks. What happens in 1994 is Iceland becomes member of the European...
The European Economic Area?
Thank you.
Yes, yes,
thank
yes,
you.
That's it.
And that forces Icelanders, the Icelandic financial system, to become more liberalized. Liberalized in a sense that before that, there were, for example, currency controls. People could not freely buy foreign holdings. If you went abroad, you had to go to a bank with your airline ticket and show that you were going there and you had got some maximum amount of money. This is before Visa cards were, for example, commonplace. Incidentally, I worked servicing people, and I had an instance where one of my best friends came to the bank. I know he was going to Japan. He forgot his airline ticket, and I sent him back home and said, "You need an airline ticket," even though I knew he was going to Japan. So
there were strong rules and regulations.
This is a good example how rigid the system was. But following this, things began changing rapidly. We have a new stock market. People begin investing abroad. So in 1997, when I come home from Iceland, having just been in the States working at a brokerage unit, this business was just really beginning. And that is a more like a brokerage business versus rigid banking. It was becoming more, I don't like to say maybe internationalized, because it differs greatly among countries how much people participate in the stock market. But we were evolving pretty quickly into more like, one could maybe say, an American nice way of banking, investment banking.
Now, was this change triggered by people from abroad, or was it really your own idea?
This change was triggered, well, one could say, there's not really maybe one explanation. I do like to use, since Iceland is traditionally a nation of farmers and agriculture, I like to use the term that Icelanders were maybe like cows that had been locked inside for the whole winter and were being let out during the spring after this all this while. It was just like freedom. And what do cows do the first days? It is actually a pretty memorable sight. They run wild. They really do not know what to do.
And your bankers went right through the fencing, apparently.
Very much. That's very much true. And for the first, I come to Iceland in 97. I began working at what was then the Agricultural Bank that had just started like an investment and brokerage unit. And the first few years, this is very much forgotten today, but the first few years, there were actually massive improvements done in the banking system. All of a sudden, loans were being facilitated to people with good business ideas, as opposed to merely having political connections. The interbank market began in 1998. The interbank market is basically a market where banks lend each other short term. So that meant, for example, that a bank that maybe had for years usually had something like, I just know this from a small bank I was working at, it had something in the region of 4 million euros sitting idle each day, as opposed to being lent to other banks earning some interest. So the system in general, it became more efficient. And that was the trend until, I would say, maybe 2001, 2002. And what is happening during this time, that the banking system that had been, I'm not going to in history here, but the banking system had been very much closed since 1930, following the collapse, the general collapse in the world. It had been very much closed, isolated. And once this happened, this general trend in 95, things began changing rapidly. And the regulators, they need to adapt the regulation system. They got a hard time adapting to the new rules, the new financial landscape, so to speak.
You mean the people who had to control the banks? They, and what was so difficult? Because it was changing so rapidly, or were they understaffed? Or?
Well, they were actually understaffed, but the rules that were used, they were aimed at a banking system where you basically, you did not have a stock market. You could not move money freely between countries. All of a sudden, people were sending money to Iceland from Iceland. They were investing in stocks. They were making forward contracts. This is a very swift change. So the financial supervisory, they were basically copy-pasting regulations from the European area. And those regulations were highly inadequate because Europeans had not, until rather recently, participated heavily in the stock markets.
So, and why didn't they copy-paste from the U.S.? Because there were no regulations there.
Well, actually, the regulations in the U.S. are, from my standpoint, they're much better. But they're also more complicated. And to set up such regulations and have someone follow those regulations is very difficult. To put added spice into this equation, I hope I'm not confusing my listeners with this, what happens in 1999 is that an act in the United States called the Glass-Steagall Act is abolished. What that meant was that investment banking, the banking business where banks actively participate in buying and selling companies and participate in the stock market, they can combine their business with regular banking. Regular banking meaning you put a deposit in a bank, money in deposit, and the bank lends people for some general consumption, buying a car, buying a house maybe. So this created a scenario where banks began combining their business very rapidly. And this influenced not only American banks, but European banks began copying this pretty quickly. Me now being in Belgium, examples that come to my mind are UBS in Switzerland. They bought Payne Webber, a brokerage company in the United States, and ING, they made inroads into all kinds of banking activities also in the States. So all of a sudden you had this landscape, financial landscape, where traditional banking was very old. And this was a general trend all over the, well, all over the world, well, in the Western world at least. And you had Icelandic bankers finally entering the international banking arena, and this is what they see. This is what people that are actually doing something are frantically doing. And in 2002, the banks in Iceland, they become more or less privately owned. This bank had been owned by the government. As I explained, these were basically politicized banks. But little by little, in 1998, the government began selling shares in the banks. That process was mostly done by 2002, 2003. And what happens is that one bank, Landsbanki, the majority stake, approximately 40%, is sold to a group of investors that was mainly a father and son business who had made immense amount of money in the brewery field in Russia. And the other bank, the agricultural bank, it was mainly sold to an investment bank in Iceland. And ironically, the investment bank that bought the agricultural bank, it had been 50-50% owned by the agricultural bank only 6 years prior to the, how should one say, the young bank, the young Danish bank, only 6 years later. One could say that that was probably the signal to society that being a daredevil banker, that's where the, how should I put it, the heroes were working.
I read something about Viking bankers.
Yes.
An image that was very fiercely promoted in the media that were then mostly owned by those same people, apparently.
Yes, little by little, these bankers began owning the media, and the media, of course,
they glorify them.
Yeah, thanks. Glorified is the best word. Yeah, I couldn't have put it better. So, during this period, I only worked 1 year at the agricultural bank, and after that, I began working at a savings bank. It was a big savings bank, but it was relatively small within the banking industry, but it was big enough yet to be part of this brokerage industry. And we were relatively successful, and things seemed to be somewhat fine until 2002, 2003, although there were at that point already warning signs that things were, well, things were not getting maybe out of control, but the door had definitely been opened to risky activity.
So what were those signals then?
Signals included, for example, very rapid increases in lending to the public. Property values were beginning to creep up, and there were definite signs that people were using their houses, their properties, like some people use ATMs.
ATMs, using geldautomaten. I mean, that's automatic teller machines.
Automatic teller machines.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah.
Yes, to get loans from banks. So there was already a lending orgy, so to speak, beginning to develop.
So that's not a very stable construction then.
Well, at that point, it could have been argued actually that lending had been too little for decades because the banks were being so domesticized and politics were so frequently involved, so that one could argue at that point, well, we're just reaching a more normal equilibrium of lending in a country that is moving towards free markets. But what happens is in 2002, 2003 is that all of a sudden you have private investors that own these banks. And let's not forget, Iceland is a very small country. At that point, there were less than 300,000 people living in Iceland. So you can imagine that within the financial community in Iceland, everyone knew everybody at that point.
Yes, Antwerp has 500,000 people, and everybody knows everyone too.
Yes, yes. So you just imagine how things were in Iceland. So basically, if I just retract a bit, we have a scenario where Icelandic bankers all of a sudden have gained the freedom to do pretty much whatever they want. Europe becomes attracted to stocks. There's a trend of merging investment banking to traditional banking. And also there's an incredible technological advance happening with the internet. At 1998, 2% of the world population had internet access. Only a few years later, 5 years later, that percentage, if I remember correctly, was between 40 or 50%. So you had this boom that a world that was only a few years back was a foreign, all of a sudden you're having CNBC and such TV stations with only talking about finance in all banks. People had internet access. So all of this converges into creating the perfect mix that creates a financial bubble. And as I said, you have a very small country. And what do these bankers do? They, of course, begin comparing who is the biggest. And there's a very popular book in finance written by Michael Lewis called Liar's Poker. And Liar's Poker begins a story about who was the most daredevil regarding financial decisions. And basically, the guy who has made the most clever bets at a certain period, he's called, and I quote this from the book, a big swinging dick. I'm not making this up.
And that's meant as a compliment, I suppose.
That's the ultimate compliment. One could say that such a competition began in Iceland, who was the ultimate, and I refer to Michael Lewis. And Icelandic banks, in a short period, they began lending a great deal to the public, to private companies, and they go on an acquisition binge. Their balance sheets, that is the money that they had in their portfolio, combined in 2001, was close to the amount that Icelanders made every year, the gross domestic production, GDP. And only 7 years later, the balance sheet had swelled to being somewhere between 7 or 8 times what Icelanders made.
So that was unique in Iceland?
This was very much unique in Iceland. So you do not need to be a financial expert to fathom that such rapid growth is probably a gross understatement of such a transformation. Such rapid growth means that you need new money to finance lots of lending and buying. And what happens is that when you begin putting so much new money into the system, people have more money. They have more easy access to money. And people use, and this is one of the, the mysteries of finance. And this happens again and again, that when people gain access to money, they usually act very irrationally.
Yes, that's what you call nouveau riche. Nouveau riche, newly rich.
Yes. And Iceland was definitely in no way an exception. So Icelanders, they begin investing in properties, So there was a real estate bubble in Iceland. During this period, I'm talking from memory now, in real terms, when that is in real terms, then I include the effects of inflation. Houses in Iceland between 201 and 207, they doubled in value, and just a little bit more. I think the index, real index, went from 102 at the peak, 217. So there was a huge bubble in housing. The stock market, it went up during that period from bottom to the top approximately all 7 or 8 times, somewhere in that area. Kaupthing, which was the biggest bank, its share price went up tenfold during this period. We're talking about a bank, not a company like Apple or Google. We're talking about a bank. And since there was so much price appreciation going on, the central bank thought, we need to counterattack this. So the central bank begins raising rates. And the effect of raising the rates within a system where money was flowing freely between countries was that people, and mainly businesses, began thinking, why should I borrow at such high rates? While foreigners began thinking, hey, there are really high rates in Iceland. So foreign money began flowing into Iceland, chasing those high rates, and Icelanders began taking loans in foreign denominated currencies. Mm-hmm. It's rather obvious where this is going, and probably rather obvious how badly it ended for lots of people. Money began flowing into Iceland, which made the Icelandic krona always more valuable, meaning that people that borrowed in foreign currencies, they always saw whatever they owned, the amount in Icelandic krona always became less and less.
Yes, and what about your export?
Well, exports went down for a while, but it didn't seem to matter that much because the banks were making so much money.
Yes, but you can't have a national economy only based on banks, but that was more or less the situation then.
That was the situation, and actually there were, and this was not a joke, there were serious talks about that Iceland would become the financial center of Europe.
Ooh.
There was even like a twin tower. Twin towers were raised, and the architect talked about having like Italian coffee places between the towers. It's always very windy there and often rainy at that place.
Not very Italian.
This would have never panned out, this idea. But it's a good example of how out of touch with reality things were at that point. So you have this combination of not only the banking system swelling, the banks, they're on this acquisition spree, they make money because of actually they're providing services to mm-hmm. people that they're lending, which creates profits in the short run at least. So things actually look very well, at least on the outside. But then in 2007, well, in 2006, there was a report done by Den Danske Bank, that is the Danish bank. And the guy who wrote the report even stated he wasn't going into details. He just thought that his customers should see this. Iceland was actually not on the radar of research, but he basically said Iceland looks like the new Thailand. All the symptoms are the same.
So just a little historical note, Iceland was, let's say, governed by Denmark until 1944. You were only independent in 1944.
Yes, I just
looked that up. Little side, not very important. But that maybe explains why a Danish person has more ties with Iceland than another academic.
That's correct, yes.
And when you refer to Thailand, that was before because of the Thai Eastern Asian crisis then?
In 1997, yes. Yes, what he was referring to was the Thai crisis in 97, just under a decade ago when the report was written. And he said, basically, look, Iceland shows all the same symptoms of an impending bubble.
So, and how was this report received? Did people say, oh, he's just jealous and they can't have Iceland rising high or something like that?
Exactly. That was the general reply. And that became actually, following this report, this became a concurrent theme that Danish people were very jealous of Icelandic bankers and Icelanders.
So and that's not a very intelligent way to deal with criticism, of course.
Well, not intelligent maybe, but it's probably the most effective way. One could argue that it was an effective way. And what happens is, it's today it's called the mini crisis. The Icelandic krona, it depreciates, meaning that foreign currency within just a matter of a few days, if I remember correctly, the US dollar that cost 65 kroners before the crisis all of a sudden cost 80 kroners following the brouhaha. Mm-hmm. Of the report. This report is generally called the Geysir Crisis Report. And the Icelandic stock index, it falls quite a bit. But little by little, people begin to dismiss the report. It was effective. And the Icelandic stock market again gained strength. And the Icelandic krona began again becoming stronger than ever before. For example, in spring 2007, just over a year after this Danish report was released, the Icelandic krona that had at one point needed, you needed 80 kroners to buy one US dollar, now you only needed 60 kroner to buy that same US dollar.
So even better than before?
Even better than before, yes. And one could say that the Icelandic stock market, it reached its high point in the summer of 2007. And today, Icelanders in general talk about something being 207-ish.
Okay, which means lots of money.
Lots of money, and yes, a very easy life, and people ready to buy. Well, today, it would not be flat screens, but something that is considered to be frivolous, mm-hmm. one could say. Frivolous and even... and even spending that is really has no
just to show off.
Show off spending.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yes. So, but the cracks begin showing when Northern Rock falls. All of a sudden, and this was the fall of 2007. Northern Rock was this big real estate bank in England, and what happens is that bankers all of a sudden begin dismissing the certainty that banks never fail. And this causes what is called the CDX index to skyrocket on Icelandic bank debt. And that is basically the possibility of Icelandic debt becoming defaulting, that banks mm-hmm. in Iceland would default. And what it measures pretty much is the added interest that should be added to government bonds. For example, if a government bond is paying 5%, if the CDS spread is 500 points, then it should be 10%. 500 points meaning 5%. You should be asking for 10% from a bank bond, mm-hmm. similar in maturity as a government bond. And what happens very rapidly is that this index begins skyrocketing for Icelandic banks. And it becomes so high that it is impossible for Icelandic banks to actually make money because all new loans would require such high interest rates. In a desperate attempt, Icelandic banks create internet banks in the UK, the Netherlands, and those banks offer the highest interest rates. And this worked for a while, mm-hmm. but the trouble with internet bank accounts is that that's a very unstable customer base. The first sign of trouble and people rush to the computers, one click and the money is gone. But this, at least for temporarily, managed to solve the temporary issues of financing. One thing that became emerging really quickly, though, was that Icelandic banks, in this manic, I call this the manic millennium, they had financed themselves very short and lent very long, meaning that banks in general, they financed themselves maybe on average 4 or 5 years, meaning that the money that they received, they need to repay it back in 4 or 5 years. I don't remember the percentages, but there was an incredible amount that they needed to pay back within 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens in 2007 and 2008 is that when lending between banks begins freezing up following Northern Rock becoming insolvent, what happens is that foreign banks begin seeing Icelandic banks as potential trouble. So they become ever less inclined refinancing their debts. So even though it turned out that the bank's portfolios were in some cases shockingly worthless, the main reason why the Icelandic banks went all bankrupt within days in October 2008 was that that was very similar to Enron only a few years back. Nobody, how should I put it, within quotation marks, loved them anymore. Nobody trusted them. So they had problems refinancing themselves. What happens is that the Icelandic Central Bank, that had been monitoring the situation for quite a while, they realized that they cannot salvage the banks. As I said, they were 7 to 8 times the Icelandic gross domestic production. So the banking system was way too big for the central bank to salvage the banking system.
That was even no option then?
That was no option. An emergency law was set so Icelandic depositors, they would not lose any money. That has created a great deal of controversy. And foreigners, they lose incredible amounts of money. The amount that foreigners lost, the estimated amount, is not only historic recently, nor historic per capita. If you combine the three banks, the default losses of the three Icelandic banks, only the bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers has created more losses in financial history since 1926.
Yes, that's.
And we're talking about everything. There were less losses for Enron than Glitnir Bank and Kaupthing Bank in Iceland. And Landsbanki was only slightly less losses from Landsbanki. If you put it in an Icelandic perspective, the losses were the same as the combined real estate value of all houses, real estate, land in Iceland times two.
Okay.
Meaning foreigners could have built Iceland twice with the money that they lost from the financial crash.
Now, would you still say something about this anti-terrorist law thing?
Referring to the anti-terrorist law in UK.
Yes, I think that was about that time, no?
Yes, the UK actually froze the assets of Landsbanki, which had a subsidiary in the UK. There's been a great deal of debate regarding this, and it's somewhat difficult to elaborate on it because it has yet to emerge what the true reason was that the UK government decided to use this law that one would say was rather strange, because I'm not aware that a bank has ever been put on a terrorist list before. Landsbanki was actually for a few days on a list with other terrorist groups.
And that gave then the UK government the right to What do they do?
They closed iSafe accounts in England, and those accounts were a week later, if I remember correctly, transferred to ING Bank.
Well, yes, why not?
Yes. Well, ING Bank, of course, had been rather unhappy because ING Direct had suffered losses in customers when the iSafe began. But this is something that history still has yet to reveal how suitable that was. It may prove that this may have been the right move, and this may have been a totally unjustified move. Mm-hmm. At this point, I cannot actually make any opinion about that.
That's maybe something for another interview. But I really think we ran out of time now. So we had chapter one, which means the building up of the crisis. And
yes.
if it's okay with you, I will call you sometime later to know what was so typical in the handling of the crisis afterwards.
Absolutely, no problem.